Welcome to Day 2 Cloud. Ethan Banks is here along with Ned Bellavance. And today we're going to talk about, well, Ned, tell them what we're going to talk about in this episode.
You won't believe it, but we spent almost half an hour just talking about documentation and automation. And I like, stay with me because it's way more interesting than it sounds. I know documentation isn't sexy. It's not cool, but it's absolutely necessary. And it's a great place to start with automation.
And we dig into this with William Collins, who has gotten so deep into automation, he's figured out how to put documentation into the automation process, and that is make it all part of the workflow, which made it just an incredibly riveting discussion. Despite your going documentation, come on, guys, for reals, this was really cool and part of William's philosophy of everything is code. Hope you enjoy. Well, William, welcome to Day 2 Cloud. It's lovely to have you. And if you would, introduce yourself to the nice people. Who are you and what do you do?
Hey, I'm a lead architect in healthcare, working mostly on cloud transformation stuff, automation, a little security, a lot of networking, and a little bit of other stuff sprinkled in there.
Yeah, it sounds like you said automation, you said cloud transformation, you said a lot of those keywords there. And I know as we were prepping for this show, you kind of have this philosophy of everything is code, which we definitely want to dig into that today. Everything is code, because you intimidated the crap out of me when I read that. Everything? Really? Everything? Okay. Well, let's start at the beginning, William, for people that, you were on a different Packet Pushers episode earlier. Not that many weeks ago, you were on a heavy networking episode. So maybe some people have heard you before, but for folks who have not, describe your environment for us at a high level. What sort of infrastructure are you managing? Who's consuming the infrastructure? Is it a dynamic environment? Does it change a lot? Give us kind of the high level overview so we know what you're up against.
Okay. So let's start out with, multi-public cloud isn't everybody. So multiple public clouds in the mix. We have physical network infrastructure in the form of carrier neutral facilities. So this is like Equinix, and that is going to provide the fast on ramps to different cloud providers and services. So I do a lot of the management for shared services space or hubs within each public cloud provider, more in tune with like the networking side of the house and some of the security stuff. So the infrastructure itself, as far as consumption, you're going to have like application teams, product teams, even tech teams. Basically, anyone that wants to either deploy new apps or maybe move existing apps from our traditional data centers to cloud. And then, the idea, I guess, for all this is to build these environments in such a way, providing all the components for, developers or, whoever to go fast, but, go fast responsibly with the appropriate guardrails in place. And yes, it is a dynamic infrastructure. It changes a lot. Mm.
Well, you said cloud transformation and then went on to describe that. So that you literally are moving from a legacy infrastructure into cloud. So there is a transformation going on.
Yes, sir.
Is the long-term plan to be cloud only, or are you going to operate in a hybrid environment for the foreseeable future where you've got these multi-clouds and your current on-premises stuff?
I think the short-term future for sure is going to be definitely a hybrid approach, because it for any large, Fortune 100 or, Fortune 500 business that's been built over the last, 10, 20, 30 years tends to accrue a lot of stuff. Maybe they have data centers, they have a lot of stuff in those data centers. They have a lot of applications. Maybe some of those applications are old and they're not fully understood. You have a lot of integrated systems. So, moving from that to just being public cloud exclusive, I would say is a huge undertaking.
Sure. Yeah. You've got to maintain that heritage or legacy or whatever you want to call it, environment, especially for the stuff that doesn't move nicely. Yeah.
Whatever you provide to your customers, you just got to make sure that no matter what, it's going to be reliable. It's going to be constantly available. And then, you're not doing anything that's messing with that while also meeting your goals.
Right. And the infrastructure that's being deployed, I know you said it's a bunch of different applications and it's very dynamic. are they primarily focusing on infrastructure as a service and deploying virtual machines, or have they actually started dipping into the world of platform as a service, or heaven forbid, like serverless infrastructure?
So, you know, all of the above. We have stuff in all of those categories in production. So yeah, all of the above.
Okay, very cool. That's a lot to manage. It's not just like, oh, these are VMs in somebody else's data center. No, this is platform as a service and the serverless and all the other weird offerings that AWS or Azure or whichever public clouds you're in have to offer. So that's a challenge for you, not only from a security background, but also from a networking background, because all those different services have different networking things that don't line up nicely with the traditional networking background.
Yeah. Yeah. And even, I mean, when you think about like, I was talking to somebody the other day about this, like, what is zero trust? Like, what is zero trust for a completely self-contained environment that's, you know, under your platform as a service, you know, compared to like, how does that look from a high level compared to what infrastructure as a service sort of looks? It's just, yeah, it's, there's a lot of nuance there, a lot of differences, a lot of learning. It's fun.
I've had a bunch of those zero trust conversations lately with different vendors. With different vendors who want to explain their perspective on zero trust. So there's a part of me that's laughing because zero trust could be, well, let me sit back and cross my arms and think philosophically, what do you want zero trust to mean? We can make it mean that for you.
It's almost like, trust. You know, what is peace? You know, what is peace? That's like the extent of like, what is zero trust? Everybody's going to say something different, it seems like.
William, you have a networking background, you mentioned. What's it been like to bring network infrastructure into the cloud area, cloud era, as Ned was describing it? It's kind of, it varies a bit by cloud platform, for sure.
You know, I would say it's, you know, with its set of challenges, it's very challenging, but it's, you know, also, it's extremely rewarding. You know, all in all, I think this is the most exciting and, you know, probably the best time to ever work in technology. There's just a lot of cool things happening, you know, the way transformation's happening. And some of the, like, I know that, like, I've sort of have a long sort of track record with automation, you know, starting out, like, you know, when I started out as kind of a Linux guy, you know, there's nothing that you can't do in Linux. You know, you can do everything through a bash script. You know, so I started out in that sort of world, you know, and kind of seeing all this evolve and like how automation has evolved. Like the possibilities with automation now are just, you know, the sky's the limit. It's so fun. It's fun, really. It's a great time to work in tech.
I like the positive energy.
I was having a chat with Ivan Pepelniak on a different recording a bit ago, and we got talking about cloud networking and he kind of made the point, it's not really that different from regular networking. It's just, I don't think he put it this way, but kind of the summary was there's different guardrails in place. There's different limitations that the cloud folks put on networking in their environment because they have to. And maybe we're making too big a deal out of the differences from traditional network to quote unquote cloud networking. Does that sound about right to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think we actually talked about that on our last little chat where I think I said something to the effect of, yeah, I mean, it's not, I mean, it's still networking. It's, yeah. I think that the more of the challenge is, especially on the operational side of the house, like you're so used to logging into a router, looking at the ARP, you know, going through, you know, following a packet, you know, following, you know, what interface layer two it's coming in and out of your frames and then up through into this network device, looking at the routing table, following it to this one. And, you know, that's not the way this works anymore from the ops side of the house. I think the ops side is definitely more, I think it's a bigger transition.
Right. I know some of the public cloud providers have started to try to add tools that seem familiar to maybe allow you to follow that packet, but that only works on their like infrastructure as a service stuff. If you start using any of the other services, like, well, forget that. It doesn't exist inside my virtual network. So how can I trace a packet to SQL as a service or something like that?
Yeah. And I mean, do you blame, so like from their perspective, when they do something like that, I almost think, you know, from the, I think as an enterprise or as an, you know, some organization out there, you need to, if you're going to adopt cloud, you need to do cloud. You know, you don't want to like force the cloud provider into hammering out some janky feature that allows you to see things like you used to be able to see it, but it's not, it doesn't integrate really well into the whole system. You know, it's just, right. Why do that? Why prolong the inevitable? Why, you know, say we're not going to be future proof? We want to keep doing it the same way.
Right. Now, you mentioned automation a little bit earlier and how it's a great time to be in automation, which I love the positivity. It's really refreshing here because I know we can get a little sarcastic and a little downtrodden on Twitter when we're talking about tech. But one of the things that I think came up in an earlier conversation was that your infrastructure management strategy and automation involved Microsoft Office. I believe that might have been part of the initial pitch. So I'm envisioning lots of spreadsheets and notepad extractions. Is that what you meant? And how has it sort of changed since that initial Excel and notepad sort of setup?
So in talking about like Microsoft, I almost, and this has been like, I think this is the case for a lot of people that work in networking, is Microsoft Office or just your typical Office tools are used for all of the different things. So if I, like, let me paint a picture, and I don't really paint, by the way, but so generally,
you do now, buddy, you just committed.
So generally in like a large organization, medium, large, you have some sort of like design and architecture team, and then maybe like an engineering and ops team. Or, you know, sometimes in a smaller shop, maybe they're combined, whatever. You know, there's still functions that have to be fulfilled. So when I usually see like on the design front, you have like a new technology or, you know, a new design, and it's generally presented in a PowerPoint, like at a high level to get buy-in, to get money. So you got that piece. So you come down a little bit, and then you have, you know, people making technical diagrams, usually in Visio, you know, and that's going to represent this new design or maybe that change to an existing design. And obviously people don't, you know, they're not going to email around Visios. So they're going to export that Visio to like a PDF and, you know, either attach it to an Outlook email or a WebEx. And, you know, that makes it easier for like mass distribution. And, you know, from there, you know, the design's going to land on a SharePoint, you know, maybe 10 SharePoints. And, you know, for each team involved, you know, that has like a stake in whatever that is. And there it's going to sit and probably not be updated that much. So there's your design. You go down a little bit lower and they pass the torch over to engineering. And, you know, engineering is, you know, they got to have config standards for all the devices they own and manage. And, you know, what better place to land those than Microsoft Word? So got the standards, you know, now we need the, you know, configuration templates, you know, that we're going to use for deployment to those devices that we're going to use to paste directly in production from Secure CRT over SSH, you know, right. So let's go ahead and round out the whole Office suite by, you know, landing these in Excel or Notepad. And, you know, to make our whole experience much more memorable, any of these documents or configs can and will be distributed amongst multiple teams, you know, possibly updated and redistributed again and again and again. So to me, this whole like life cycle of managing it doesn't even, you know, anything is not good because it's not consistent. And in order to automate, you need repeatability. And all of these things are adverse to repeatability.
Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, I've been through this experience myself, both working at a company and then working as a consultant within the confines of multiple companies is, yeah, the documentation lives in Word, where it goes to die on a SharePoint site that no one will ever update or find. And having those kind of standards across everything is really, really, that's hard. So how do you even approach that sort of mindset where you want things like version tracking? You want a single source of truth. This is how we do it. And it's a living document, not this thing that gets copied and pasted into 20 SharePoint repositories. You can never find it again. What do you do to improve that process?
This is probably the hardest part. For people that are like new to coming into this other world, you know, they hit this first hurdle and it just scares and confuses because the whole thing is, you know, we want to have a more like we want to have a, like something that I think would be an important takeaway is like having a consistent tool chain across all of our teams that are doing technology, you know, and having a repeatable, you know, method of doing things. It's like standardized. And what better way to do that than through code, you know, using version control, you know, getting into the same sort of, you know, tools. It's, you know, having that consistency and cohesion across teams is really important. And, you know, in order to do that, ultimately, the decision has to be made higher than, you know, your head. It's got to be a high level leadership decision, you know, that, you know, hey, we want to be serious about something like, say, automation. What do we have to do to make that happen?
Mm-hmm.
Well, does this go back to your idea of everything as code? You know, that is, we hear about infrastructure as code now and so on. And you, in your notes, as we were preparing for the show, it said everything as code was part of your transformation philosophy. So is that actually what you mean? Everything as code? Because that sounds awfully intimidating. I got to tell you.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. So it, like, I would say, you know, there's no special meaning behind it, but the point is it, you know, taking the conscientious effort and actually strategizing around the idea that if it can be managed in code and it makes sense, then, you know, that's the way we're going to do it. And, you know, it can't be just, you know, our own little team. You know, it's if we want to do automation at scale, because if you look at like a giant workflow, like a standing up a new service from conception to production, there's, you know, especially in a hybrid environment, there's probably a lot of teams that have something that they have to do in that long workflow. So until you can get those teams on the same page, speak in the same language, it's not going to be quick. It's not going to be agile.
Maybe I just want to keep it to myself and throw it over the wall when I'm done with it. What's wrong with that?
You're not DevOps, man. You gotta be the DevOps. And maybe I can like add some clarity around that and defining like the problem in a little more detail and why this idea might make sense to solve it. So like say that, you know, like I said, you have a large org, you know, you potentially have dozens of teams working across your tech stack. Automation is the hot item and, you know, doing it right across all these teams and technologies. Hey, it's a big undertaking. So, you know, for this to happen, you know, it's definitely going to help to have that commonality. And, you know, like if I'm thinking from my leadership's perspective, like someone high up the food chain and they're like, okay, I have all these different teams, they're working in technology, you know, we have self-driving cars, my Tesla drove me to work this morning, you know, my coffee maker turned on automatically, and, you know, all these things are, they're automated, you know, why can't all my teams have that, you know, collaboration and stand up a new service in an automated fashion? It's almost like they're not speaking the same language. And, you know, sometimes I'm inclined to think that that's true. You know, we're not speaking the same language. You know, if you talk to security, it's almost like they're speaking a different language than network. You know, you talk to the cloud team, they're speaking a different language than, you know, the network team, who's speaking a different language than the developers. It's, you know, until you can get all that on the same page, you know, it's going to be a stumbling block for cloud adoption, agility, automation, all these fancy buzzwords we have all been acquainted with as of late.
Now, you said if we're taking the perspective of someone who's looking from the top down and says, wow, I've got all these different groups, none of them are speaking the same language, none of them are using the same process, it would make so much more sense if we could all kind of get together and choose a common process and maybe even tool set. That's easy to observe from the top down, but actually getting buy-in from the ground up is challenging, to say the least. So how do you even approach getting that coherence between all these different groups?
Yeah, it's difficult. It's challenging. And, you know, the first thing, you have your executive buy-in. And then as you filter down, you have to have people that are transformative in each one of these verticals that, you know, oftentimes, like what I've observed is, you know, and just over the past 10, 15 years and working in this industry, is like, we, like as a networking team, maybe, you know, we do things this way, we expect things in a certain way. And if it's not this way, we're just going to like reject your request, or, you know, we're not going to help you. You know, everything has to be this way. And so, I mean, the first step and sort of making this happen is you've got to reach across the aisle. You've got to, you know, you've got to do the opposite of what like American politics are doing right now. You have to, and for me, man, that's been, you know, taking, you know, trips over to the data center, talking to our NOC in person, you know, meeting with our security team in person, you know, really like integrating myself with our cloud platform groups and, you know, learning their workflows, being there in person, you know, developing relationships. And then, you know, if you think about all these different verticals, okay, networking is a huge part, infrastructure is a huge part, and, you know, security is a huge part. So if you can get three or four people from all these different verticals that also have good relationships with their, you know, sub teams, you know, just traditional network engineering, then, you know, that's sort of how this thing sort of begins. And then, you know, understanding the, you know, why would we actually even want to do this? Like what good does it do us? And then, you know, another thing too, like I've been doing demonstrations to show. So like in the past few weeks, like I've automated a sort of something they were doing in cloud manually that had to do with, it was like a cross between networking and sort of onboarding of a new environment. And I pulled some pieces together, you know, put it together in Ansible Tower as a workflow and, you know, sort of demoed it and showed them all the pieces. And they're like, okay, this is really good. And do the same thing for the security guys. Do the same thing for the NOC. Like go around and almost evangelize things, not just with your words, but hey, let's get together. Let's either do a WebEx or I'll come over in person. Let me show you how this works and show you like what you're doing now can largely be automated. It can be a lot easier for you.
Yeah, and you've mentioned this multiple times, the importance of being in person, which might take some people off guard for a second. I mean, you know, as someone in technology who may not always be the most extroverted person and people are icky, I don't want to talk to them. But you're saying, no, Ned, you actually, not only should you talk to them, but not over a video chat, but actually go speak to that person directly. Why do you think you have such a focus on doing it in person as opposed to any of the various electronic communications you could use?
Yeah, like take a shower and wear pants. I mean, come on. It's a huge thing you're asking here.
So now it's funny that now that you say that, I look back at like the way I was talking and it almost seems like I have like an anti like remote work agenda here, but I promise you that's not the case. I mean, I guess it's just, you know, from my most recent experiences, I've done a lot of remote work over the years and I've done a lot of in-person work. And I am a, you know, if I can work from home, I'm going to work from home. It's easier. I'm not sitting in traffic. I'm not, you know, I can maximize my time better. But something that like I found, and this is just for me, you know, this isn't for everybody, but being in person and develop, like making the relationship with some of these different teams a little more personal, being there in person, demoing in person, getting to know them, you know, showing them that, you know, I think it goes a long way into saying that, you know, I'm here to be part of your team and I'm trying to work with you. And, you know, I'm here to build a relationship and make things better. And for some reason, you know, I've done this remotely and I've done it in person. And for some reason, every time I think in person has helped things move a little easier, a little quicker even, and just a little more efficient.
Yeah, I agree with that. The best experiences I've had on infrastructure building is when I've gotten out of my cube and headed over to someone else's cube that didn't work necessarily under the same manager or whatever, but they were part of the project, and go chat with them and go, maybe they were a developer trying to deploy on infrastructure they'd asked me to build out for them. And I'd go, okay, you asked for this. You wanted these VLANs. You're asking for these network ports. You're looking for, you know, the various things here. But I don't have any context for this. What are we building? What's happening? And then it would turn into this. Sometimes there would be a sigh, but then it would turn into a conversation. And having that conversation in person with that that fellow IT human would turn into a context-rich discussion about what's being built and why. And sometimes what they asked for was fine, but sometimes what they asked for could have been improved to better meet the goals of the business for whatever that application deployment was. And again, being in person knocks down barriers and builds trust very quickly in a way that, for all the wonders of using Zoom conferencing, of which I'm a big fan, it's different somehow in person. You're breathing the same air. It somehow it creates a trust and a bond there that you can work with that person to get things done rapidly.
Yeah. And I don't know how to explain it, because I mean, I prefer working from home any day of the week. You know, I think the ability to actually work remotely increases your organization's chance to get like top talent, you add top talent to your strategy. But for some reason, you know, some of these things just, maybe it's me, maybe it's the way I communicate, but, you know, being in a room with a whiteboard with a group of developers, I can gain a lot more ground than, you know, my preconceived idea of like a team of developers over a WebEx. It can be challenging sometimes.
I don't think it's just you. I mean, I had one job where I live in the northeast of the US in New Hampshire, and had a job where everything was happening in Columbus, Ohio. Okay, so I did a lot of remote stuff, but the way we built that trust is quarterly, we'd have an all-hands meeting in Ohio. I would get on a plane and I'd go, and we'd sit in a room and do a lot of design work together as a team. And that helped enormously to when we went back to being remote wherever we were, still being able to get things done, because that time spent in person at those quarterly meetings made a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
So William, I think we can do a little mini case study here. One of the things you described early on was all the different ways in which Microsoft Office was a part of your documentation and project management strategy, but you've said everything is code, and we've talked about this challenge of getting people unified. Getting people unified around documentation can be kind of a big deal. So if we're going, even with documentation, into this everything is code mentality, can you talk about how you've transformed your documentation, or how you're trying to how you are transforming perhaps your documentation so that there's a, an automated process to it? There's an everything is code feel about it, and how that's impacted the team that you work with.
There's a few types, you know, varying types of documentation that I think can be discussed here, but I'm going to just go ahead and throw out the sort of like where this, I mean, this isn't my idea, obviously. This is a huge thing. You know, if you go and Google search, you could probably find, you know, a ton of different stuff. But just me, a long time ago, years ago, I had this sort of thing where, you know, I started working in a big Microsoft shop. You know, everybody doing code related stuff is using Visual Studio or, you know, VS Code. And, you know, it's integrated into the ecosystem. They're a Microsoft shop. They, you know, have all this stuff going on, and I'm sitting here and I'm using Vim. You know, I have Vim extended with plugins to like, yeah, I'm a longtime Vim user. And I'm like, okay.
Good man.
I gotta figure out how to use VS Code. And, you know, what better way to do it than, you know, go through some thing that I do pretty regularly to learn all the ins and outs and see if I can actually use this GUI for, you know, writing stuff. And which, come to find out, you know, you can, there's a plugin for Vim keyboard integration for keyboard shortcuts, and it's not that bad. So all in. Right. So for me, I took the example of like, okay, I'm just going to do a document. I'm going to, you know, I have this, you know, regular designs that I make or architectural frameworks, whatever I'm doing, but I'm going to make a document in VS Code. So, you know, there's going to be no branching. You know, I'm just committing everything to master. Nobody else is contributing. You know, it's just for me. It's just for learning VS Code. So made a Git repo. I have a, you know, whatever document name .md, and I have an image folder, you know, that has, you know, pretty pictures in it. That's it. So I built a standard landing page that would be like the, title page for all my documentation, and automatically populate a table of contents and, you know, a predefined document structure. And all this is, you know, extensible and, you know, using keyboard shortcuts and snippets. It's, you know, easy to get started and, you know, I'm ready to start writing Markdown. Well, I get done. I, you know, hit a keyboard shortcut to update the table of contents. I, you know, export it to a PDF, like in that Git repo. you know, and I commit to master like a true ninja, I'm done. And then I, you know, I keep it updated regularly, but it really helped me learn VS Code, and it helped me kind of pull away from Vim and sort of take that step of faith to something else. And in my takeaway here after all this was done is, okay, this isn't really an efficient way to do documentation, but man, I'm writing in Markdown, and you know, I'm pretty good at it now. My work is, you know, repeatable. It's in source control for this design. The snippet stuff and all the keyboard shortcuts to do things they're pretty efficient. You know, VS Code isn't that bad. You know, I can use it. So, you know, fast forward a little while, and you know, we're starting to build an automation practice, and you know, we're getting a little more collaborative. You know, network automation is progressing. My fellow team members are building up their Git chops, and we're, you know, starting to hustle packets and use dev speak around the office. So the next iteration of this gets a little more structure, adds more collaboration, and starts getting us salty network guys in a more like developer style mindset, right? So let's say the project is, say we built an Ansible role for like Cisco iOS XE stuff or something, I don't know. So we start using, you know, branches. You know, we keep it simple. We have a master branch and, you know, a dev branch. The dev branch serves as our like a integration branch for new stuff. And the new stuff we branch from dev and never straight from master. And let's say we're using Ansible Tower, and you know, we have a project in Tower called prod, which points to, you know, the prod branch of our Git project, and you know, it's run against a production specific inventory. And then we have a project in Tower for dev, you know, which points to the dev branch, and then you know, has a non-production inventory. So one of my engineers, he creates a local branch from dev, makes, you know, changes, you know, commits, and, you know, creates a pull request because he wants it back in that dev repo so he can test it against, you know, pre-production environment. Well, oh no, his code is good, but he didn't update the existing documentation to reflect his new changes. And with our new model, our documentation for a specific, you know, design service or automation, whatever we're doing within that repo, that documentation is going to follow the life cycle of whatever it is that it's describing. So it gets blocked and he's got to update the documentation before it can get merged. You know, so takeaway here is now we have something a little more collaborative. It's approaching, you know, documentation kind of efficiently, and, you know, it's tied to what it's describing.
And it's at this point you've integrated it into the workflow somewhat. So there's an opportunity to have that be a data point, which you could, as you said, accept or reject a merge request. Hey, man, you got to document this or we're not merging it in. Sorry, buddy.
Yeah. And I'm big on documentation. I personally like peer review documentation as it's being, you know, especially with the network stuff, as it's being integrated. So I'm a stickler for this, you know, because it's everywhere you go to, documentation always seems to be like a challenge. And really, once you have you build that initial documentation for something, updating it as you update a project or something else, I mean, it's not very much time. So put the little time into it to keep it going.
But documentation, it's not sexy. You know, that's not the cool thing. I mean, you said like, I'm committing to master like a ninja. I ain't got time for this documentation nonsense. I need my pipeline to kick off now so I can, you know, deploy on a Friday and go home.
That's where we're going next. We're going into sexy. We're going into, you know, building release pipelines. We're gonna hit that. We're getting there.
Oh, but all this documentation is just bringing me down. No, I feel deeply on the documentation as someone who writes it as part of my living. and this process sounds very familiar to me, where when I am writing documentation for one of the companies I'm working with, this is basically the same flow that they're talking about. I create a branch and write my documentation in the branch, and then I have to push it up and then issue a pull request, and then it will be peer reviewed. And, you know, if it is found lacking, then I have to go back and update and push again and comment, which has forced me to learn much more about GitHub than me as a lowly infrastructure person ever thought I would have to. But yeah, that's part of the process. Getting into the automation sphere a little bit, does your documentation, does it hit like a CI or some sort of approval process that's automated as well? Or is that more of a just peer review and check it out kind of thing?
So at this point right now, in the stage for, okay, like I'm collaborative, but it's maybe only within my team. And what I've just described was like my next iteration of kind of doing this. It was only, it goes through two approvals. Two approvals get merged back up to dev, and then, you know, testing is done against a pre-prod environment, and then we can, you know, bring it up to prod, which, you know, is production, obviously.
Right.
So I think the next iteration of this, like when I think of, you know, we talked about how we want to transcend like our team. We want to go a little bit further. And this type of documentation I was just talking about, you know, we're talking infrastructure. We're not delivering applications, you know, so having some documentation that follows the life cycle of this sort of, you know, Ansible, Terraform, whatever, in this repository, you know, it's a little like smaller scale. So in terms of like getting more collaborative, multi-team, let's say that, you know, we have more teams that are buying in on this. You know, the code stuff is cool. You know, automation is taking off like across our organization, you know, collaboration rocks. So let's say we want to put a unified face, you know, for all of our IT teams to the rest of the organization that, you know, comes to us for stuff. So we want to sort of wipe away that impression we talked about earlier of like all of our teams are not speaking the same language, unified, whatever. So this is where like the larger you get, the more it makes sense to sort of get into the CI/CD stuff, or the more complex or technical something that you're doing is, you know, it's, you know, it makes sense. So enter Hugo. Hugo is a cross-platform. It's like it's a static generator. So basically you have a Git repo with a directory full of configs, templates, content, you know, written in Markdown, which is basically rendered into a full-blown website, you know. So this framework, it's open source, it's written in Go, it's fast. I think if you YouTube it, you can find people like building like 5,000 page sites in like 5 seconds or less. You know, it's like the Tesla Roadster of wow, static site generation. Mm-hmm. Pretty awesome. And one cool thing about it is, you know, and I've had a lot of experience with trying to do like internal wikis or internal sites that encompass multiple teams. And that is a challenge because of the way it's hosted, how people can contribute. It's not built into their tool set that they're already using. It's just a pain. But the cool thing about this is it can be built into your tool chain and you can host it anywhere. You can host it on a Linux server, on GitHub, GitLab, you know, whatever you want to host it on.
Mm. Yeah. I've been looking into a few different packages like this. Hugo, you've mentioned that one, is a new one here, but there's different Python tools that'll do this. Hang on, going back through my Twitter stream very quickly. Oh, Sphinx, that was one. Sphinx is out there. That'll do that for you. There's a read the docs template for that. MK Docs is out there.
Jekyll.
That appears. I haven't actually dug into these, but that's another one that appears like it'll take your Markdown and build a static site for you, and it'll do a read the docs template. I'm saying read the docs template because readthedocs.io hosts a bunch of documentation for a variety of open source projects. I love the template. It's very clean. It's very logical, very easy to go through. And like you said, the resulting files that come out of that static page generation, you can put it anywhere and it's super, super convenient. That's something even for a lab environment I'm building out right now, I need documentation, and that seems like the best way to go rather than I'm going to build a web server and put a huge wiki thing on it and, you know, do it like that. It looks like, Markdown, static pages, that's probably all I really need to do. And ideally, I'll be able to integrate it into my automation workflow as I go.
Yeah, and it's portable. You know, like you said, it's super portable. You can put it anywhere. And it's beautiful. Like there's some themes that are just, I mean, you can make it look really nice and you can tailor it to your you know, the color schemes or the, you know, the drill downs, however, you know, what makes sense for how your, you know, your teams are structured. And, you know, with those, you know, additional teams, you know, you want that additional control and, you know, refinement. So, you know, maybe you want to, you know, include some real CI/CD stuff. And, you know, so like, say that we take this site that, you know, we're generating from Markdown, you know, we've written, we, you know, we use our Git repo as like an input for some sort of, you know, build pipeline, you know, so there's our continuous integration. And this, you know, this is going to produce an artifact, and then we have some release pipelines. So, you know, that takes that, that build artifact and promotes it to, like, say we have different environments, or say we just have two environments, I don't know, whatever makes sense, but it promotes it through your environments, you know, say like a pre-production, and then you can review it and, you know, prior to final deployment. And that gives you your ability to utilize pipelines for scheduling things on a regular basis, or, you know, if you want to trigger stuff automatically or manually, I mean, you know, you can do that too, but yeah, you know, it takes you to that next level.
Yeah, I'm 100% on board with the documentation in Markdown. Use the static site generator. I use Hugo and I like it, but as Ethan mentioned, there's a bunch of other tool sets out there that are available that, you know, take different formats, and some use Python and some use Go as the background. Now, as you have been rolling into this sort of, we'll call it net DevOps way of doing things and using everything as code, I'm sure it hasn't gone 100% smooth the entire way out. So could you tell us a story of where mistakes may have been made, or some of the lessons you've learned along the way?
Oh, way to go with the downer question, Ned. That's
right. This has been way too upbeat, people.
Why do you always point me to my mistakes? Come on. So, I like the first thing, the whole like DevOps mentality of like, you know, fail fast. And, you know, it's not, we, you know, there's such a culture, especially coming back to networking, because the blast radius is so much bigger, where, you know, people really focus on the failures. And I think that's a cultural shift that has to happen, where, you know, you can't just look at the failures, because if you keep looking at the failures, then you're still going to continue to have the same practices where you're going to save 100 network changes to only happen on, you know, two nights per quarter or something, you know, crazy. You know, that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but, you know, you get the point. So if we don't look at the failure and we look at the, okay, we're going to break everything into smaller changes, tiny, tiny, tiny changes, and we're going to do them regularly, you know, I think that's a lesson I learned, is like that whole, like identifying like within, because every culture is going to be different. You know, some cultures are going to do things better than others and maybe do things, you know, worse than others. And, you know, you got to focus in on where those gaps are in the culture before you actually start, you know, taking that application to the technology. Because you can't enter into net DevOps with the idea that, you know, through your change management process, you can only make changes like, you know, three nights of the month or something. You know, it just, it's really difficult, because then you're saving things up and it's like, okay, I got to fit as many changes as I possibly can into these 3 nights and, you know, cross my fingers and hope for the best. And the more changes that you introduce, the higher the likelihood is for failure. You're going to have something go wrong, probably. So.
Yeah. I've heard that philosophy before of, and I'm sure it's very common to the DevOps community, make small, frequent changes that you can recover from. And it not only reduces how many changes, so it's easier to figure out what broke and why, but it also develops the muscle memory, or whatever you want to call it, of your team. You're always doing changes. And when something small breaks, the process for recovering from that becomes something that's well-known and practiced, as opposed to a mad scramble twice a quarter to try to get something implemented and then roll it back when it didn't work properly. So I think that's makes a lot of sense to me. Was there any other major things that you learned along the way, in addition to just, you know, actually doing the DevOps process of small frequent changes?
I think, especially like specific to automation, there's, I think, and I even had this sort of thing, you know, a problem with this when I first started this. Everybody seems to like pick a tool or a way of doing things and they really want to stick to it. And I think, especially when you're getting into public cloud and you're looking at like, okay, like infrastructure as code, you know, by definition, this is immutable, you know, and, you know, maybe this ought to map to public cloud or, you know, anything on the networking side where my forwarding and control plane are separate, you know, or anything that, you know, the forwarding and other network functions are really abstracted from physical hardware, you know, so there, hey, that's a good use case for Terraform. You know, it makes sense to use Terraform there. You know, I can't take the mentality of I'm going to try and use Terraform and force it everywhere that I possibly can, even where it doesn't make sense, because I just want to have, you know, I want it to be Terraform. You know, that's a bad idea. You know, so in configuration management related stuff, you know, it's mutable. You're dealing with physical hardware. This is going to be most of everything else. It's going to map to physical infrastructure. You know, it might make sense to use something like Ansible there. You know, so picking the right tool for the right job and, you know, don't force things. You know, I would say that's a lesson that I've learned, you know, the hard way in the past sometimes. But yeah, it's just don't force things, think it through and use the right tool for the right job.
Well, along those lines, then, what other takeaways have you got for people? William, what other things would you like to leave with them as we leave this gentle podcast episode and move on into our daily lives?
Hey, if you want to get into cloud, network automation, if you want to mess around with Terraform, Ansible, you know, all this stuff is, you know, save for, you know, getting into the public cloud itself, but all the tooling and everything, you can lab out at your house. It's all, you know, open source flavors of just about everything. You know, so there is no, I guess there's no, nothing getting in your way. If you want to do it, don't wait. Don't wait for your organization to try to bring in some tool to use. You know, get down to the nitty gritty, start using it, you know, figure it out. So, you know, that way when your org does come along and try and introduce it or ask if it's a good fit, you know, you can step in and be that person that says, look, you know, I've got, you know, I've done this before, you know, I can help drive this. And you know, that'll help you get ahead.
The more you get into it, the less intimidating it is.
Absolutely. And then you're ready to, you know, whereas other people around you might be, okay, what's this? You know, why do we want to use this? I mean, you're going to be there for all the answers. So, you know, if you want to get ahead in your career and you want to like move towards, you know, that type of work, you know, that's what you got to do. And don't be afraid to think outside of the box, think differently. You know, I know working in a large SD-WAN deployment helped me there, you know, just like the whole posturing process, like going from like ZTP to, you know, the authentication to VBOND to, you know, how vSmart works, all of those things and how they all came together and worked with ZTP really helped me kind of tailor how I was writing, you know, even automation in Ansible, you know, so don't be afraid to think outside the box and try new stuff.
Well, William, if people want to ask you follow-up questions, just ping you, just tell you what an amazing person you are for coming on the Day 2 Cloud podcast, how can they do that? Where can they find you?
I am on Twitter, wcollins502, and then LinkedIn, William-Collins. I'm not blogging or anything at the moment.
wcollins502. Okay, let's all remember 502. Is there anything special behind 502, or is that something Twitter just said? Use 502, William W. Collins.
So other than not being able to find anything or any combination of stuff with my name, you know, I work in Louisville, Kentucky. So 502, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the area code for the phone number there. So
aha, got it. Okay.
Makes sense now. Well,
fair enough. I was thinking server code, HTTP server code, and trying to remember what the heck a 502 might be, but okay. Louisville area code. Fair enough.
Makes sense.
Fair enough. Thanks for showing up on Day 2 Cloud, Wayne. We really appreciate it. Virtual high fives to you out there listening and for tuning in. And if you have suggestions for future shows, we want to hear them. I'm on Twitter, Ethan Banks at EC Banks, and Ned Bellavance at Ned 1313. And if you don't like Twitter, You can go to Ned's fancy website, nedinthecloud.com. Use the form there to tell us what you want us to podcast about. And hey, something else for you you might not know. Packet Pushers, the Packet Pushers Podcast Network. We have a weekly newsletter called Human Infrastructure Magazine. HIM is loaded with the very best stuff that we found on the internet, plus our own feature articles and commentary. It's free. It doesn't suck. Get the next issue via packetpushers.net/newsletter. And until then, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.